The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Incomparable, number 609, April 2022.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, most of the time, Jason Snell. In this episode, we're going to be opening up the old movie club.
Old movie club.
And talking about two films. David, you okay? It's hard. It's harder than it looks.
He's got some Lutz in his throat.
Ooh, yeah, I got a Lutz caught in there.
We're gonna
George McCready is joining the podcast now. Hi, George.
Back to two films that are about, you know, I've had a couple of friends involved in the federal government, and I've received calls about their patriotism. One of the questions that I always like that makes me want to giggle out loud, but I don't do it because the FBI doesn't appreciate that, is, has your friend ever advocated for the violent overthrow of the United States government? And I say, no, friend, who would do that? And the answer is
Burt Lancaster, apparently.
Burt Lancaster and sort of Frank Sinatra, yeah, in the two movies that we're going to be discussing, Suddenly from 1954 and 7 Days in May from 1964. Let me introduce Philip Michaels, who you just heard, who picks these movies for us. Phil, any reason why the overthrow of the United States government was on your mind?
No, none whatsoever. I can't think of anything. Just hope we're going to do a lot of chopping tonight, Jason. A lot of chopping.
No reason. I think you sent me this suggestion last year, in fact.
Yes. But it's been on the list for a while. for some reason, it's just been on my mind, I guess. It kind of free-floating things.
And about, Phil, if you should get a job with the federal government, I will have to say that he does not advocate for the violent overthrow of the federal government.
You'd be lying.
But he does advocate for films about the violent overthrow of the U.S. government. So that's how you have to take that. Let me introduce our other panelists who have joined us to discuss these old movies. As you might expect, Shelley Brisbane, the host of a podcast that whose name I always get wrong, it's Lions, Towers, and Shields on The Incomparable, is here. Hi, Shelley.
Hello. I won the Silver Star.
Oh, did you now? Let me hear. That means you're a killer.
I repeat that several times during the podcast.
I killed 17 Japanese people or 27 Germans. It doesn't really matter which,
but
I won.
I won the Silver Star. David J. Lohr is also here. Hello.
Hi. I just want to say, here's a rain check. Put it away somewhere safe and dry so you don't lose it.
And here's a guy who maybe we'll send down to the town to check out on people. Oh no, that's a bit terrible job for Moises Chuyan. Hello.
like Paul Frees, I will go to the haunted mansion.
Look for a moose and squirrel.
Phil,
yes,
why did you pick these movies?
Oh, that seems like a more loaded question than I was hoping for. So
Phil just really loves misogyny in cinema. That's one of his favorite things.
I actually do like Suddenly. I think Suddenly is an interesting picture. I like the fact that it's Frank Sinatra playing against the type that he played in movies, maybe not so much in real life. And the fact that this was the first movie he made after winning the Oscar, I believe. So I always thought that was an interesting career trajectory that, well, now that I'm back on top of the world and the toast of Hollywood, time to make a movie where I'm killing the president.
Yep.
So that was suddenly has always been one of those off the beaten path kind of movies, because as you might imagine, it falls out of circulation quite a bit. I needed something to go with it, and 7 Days in May seemed thematically a pea in the same pod, as it were.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we are discovering the ways that you can disrupt the federal government in black and white. That's what these films are.
I mean, Suddenly is one of those films that for years, my dad was like, you have to see this movie. This movie is amazing. And when we finally found it, when it finally came out on VHS at some point, and he saw it in a bargain bin, he's like, oh, we're getting this.
And you said, no, Dad, I want a gun.
Well, you know, it gave me ideas. No. But no, it really is a good movie. It is a tight, taut, nasty little noirish film.
It is very tight, and I've always people know Philip Michaels. He likes his quick movies. He likes it.
That's right.
Yeah,
he loves film, especially as little of it as possible.
Especially if I can knock it off in one night.
Let's dive into Suddenly. Frank Sinatra. He comes to so okay. This movie starts with, of course, the, hey, friend, how do you get to Three Rivers? Also, is this the town that arms its children? Because there's a kid and he wants a gun. It's Pidge.
All it takes is a good kid with a gun.
We establish in the opening of the movie that this is a one horse fly spec, one stoplight town.
Yep.
That you drive through on the way to somewhere else.
Yep.
Is what the motorist establishes early on.
It's in the gold rush country of California, and therefore it's essentially where I grew up, and all of those other things apply.
Thought you might appreciate that.
You drive into Suddenly, and suddenly you're somewhere else.
And yes, as Jason says, boy, the children really have a weird relationship with firearms in this town.
A little bit. The idea here is that in an amusing scene where the telegram guy runs across town to find the sheriff. And then basically says we have to go back to the telegraph office so that you can read this thing. They are informed that the president of the United States will be stopping in Suddenly, not to see Suddenly, but to transfer to a car to take him to like a ranch where there's a presumably like a wealthy benefactor or something. I don't know. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, this was back in the Eisenhower days when the president did manly things outdoors and like golfing and fishing and that sort of stuff.
Don't forget splitting wood.
Chopping wood, clear and brush. And, basically the president...
Chopping has a different meaning in Suddenly, though.
The president could stop off the train and suddenly say, this town sucks and everyone, and it's a moron, and it would cost him like 12 votes is basically the thing we get from the movie.
So, oh boy, it's going to be one of those, let's put on a show, let's impress the president with how great our town is. Note, that doesn't happen. You got to keep it on the down low. You got to limit as many people, as few people as possible need to know that this is happening. But the sheriff is going to know, a bunch of Secret Service guys are going to come.
Now, the state troopers are flooding into town with cars.
But in an amazing coincidence, the sheriff's the would-be girlfriend, who is a war widow, who is the mother of the kid who just wants to shoot guns, her dad, who lives in the town, is a former Secret Service agent. And so that's an interesting connection that sort of happens coincidentally. Anyway,
and also lives in the house with the perfect view,
best
of the
view
railway station.
Of the railway station. Exactly right.
He moved to town and said, give me the house that's right by the railway station. I never want to sleep. so, at all.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's the most affordable house in town because you just got trains blasting through, not stopping, because who cares? Mm-hmm. So this all leads to that moment. So we meet these characters and we know he's sweet on the lady, but she doesn't want him to take her to church or anything like that because she's still mourning her husband. He's like, you got to get over it and date me. And she's like, no, I'm not over it.
Quit trying to buy my son a gun, please.
Yeah, and the TV is broken anyway. So there's a lot of things going on here, but the real moment that this movie pivots is we've seen the Secret Service men get there and they're setting up their security cordon, and then there's a knock on the door of the house on the hill, and it's Frank Sinatra and a couple of guys, and they say, we're with the FBI, you don't know this, but the president's coming to town and we need to secure this. And they're like, oh wow, that's great, Mr. Federal Agent. He's like, yeah, okay, let's get set up in here. And then there's one of those like, hey, wait a minute, oh, we shot a guy because dun, 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 the FBI, this guy is not with the FBI, and it wouldn't be, any student of the federal government would know, it's the Secret Service that's in charge of protecting the president, not the FBI. And it's all a lie because Frank Sinatra isn't there to protect the president. He's there to assassinate the president. Gasp. Is nobody surprised that Frank Sinatra's a cold-blooded killer? Come on.
Unsurprised.
Nope.
I mean, totally not surprised.
Was this his only explicitly bad guy role, as trivia sections all over the internet like to tell us? whether that's true or not, it feels like it's one of the few times he's distinctly supposed to be bad.
Oh, yeah.
It was his first actual villain role.
Right.
So, and I don't know that he did another like fully villainous role. He played tough guys. He played
scumbags. He played drug addicts, various things. Yeah. But he didn't really play out and out villains.
The closest would be Man with the Golden Arm, where he plays a drug addict. But he's the drug addict you root for. He's the drug addict with the heart of gold and the arm of gold too. Is the title?
It's the worst Bond film. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. So, I mean, this one, his performance is, I mean, when you learn more about what he was like as a person, maybe a bit closer to the real Frank Sinatra than the screen persona Frank Sinatra, that everybody really got acquainted with. And somebody seeing this who has seen all of his other stuff, might be a bit surprised. But for me, I hadn't seen it in a while, and it was a nice return to seeing Frank Sinatra not just do the Frank Sinatra thing, but do Frank Sinatra thing.
There are other movies where he is not doing the Frank Sinatra thing, and I grudgingly admit that he can be a good actor. See how grudging I am. This is the out-and-out villain. I wouldn't say this is my favorite or that this is his best role. He's good in this. He's interesting in it. I think the writing does him credit, too. But there are plenty of other roles where he's like Man with a Golden Arm, where he's doing dramatical stuff. Some Came Running is good,
I'll say this. I like how much I hate Frank Sinatra and Sterling Hayden equally in this movie.
Oh my God. Sterling Hayden. I want to slap him.
Stop being such a woman, Shelley.
And he doesn't always do that. He can act without doing that. And he chose badness. He just did.
I think Sterling Hayden looked at the script and looked at the production and said, mailing this one in, boys. Yeah. Doing the John Squarejaw.
Johnny
part.
Squarejaw. That is exactly who he is. I think Sinatra is good in this. He is villainous, but he's also I really love that it's like the banality of evil. Like I won the Silver Star, and you're like, you're talking it up, but yeah, he keeps changing his story. And what Sterling Hayden ends up saying to him is, you know, you just are good at killing. You aren't a hero. You're just a killer. And it's really good because Sinatra is like, he's kind of an egomaniac. He's a narcissist. He is convinced that everybody owes him something. And in the end, he is just getting paid to kill the president and then run off to South America. He hasn't really thought it through so much, as one of his co-conspirators points out. It's like, well, why don't we just take, we got half up front. Let's just take that money and run. And he's like, no, we got to stay here. And it's just, I like the character and the performance because he is so like delusional. There's a real one act play feel to this movie. Mm-hmm. And, oh, yeah. And I really like that he's not just a bad guy. He's like a delusional, you know, he's got his moments, but he's also really messed
likes
up.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I
the
like
thing
that
the writing does well is, even in a short little movie like this, Sterling Hayden spends a lot of time trying to find out what Sinatra's weakness is so that he can get the advantage. And it takes him a few tries to
Shelley,
get to it.
His weakness is electricity.
okay. Well, there you go. But it takes him a few tries to sort of get to, like, what is the point? What is the thing that's going to prove that he's a psycho or whatever? And the script does a good job of giving Sterling Hayden a couple of tries, because despite his overacting, the character is pretty smart. And it actually, one of the interesting thing about Sterling Hayden, the character, just to go back, is that, like, when they tell him the president is coming, he's the sort of small town sheriff. But Hayden is like on it, like right away. He's like, we've got to do this and this and this. Yeah. And so he's set up as a smart guy, but he's annoying to watch.
Yeah, no, he knows exactly what to do, and he takes it seriously. It's not one of those gulp, whoa, you know, kind of moments. He's like, all right, here's what we're going to do. He's very businesslike. He's not a chump of a small town sheriff. He's like, okay, I have trained my whole life for this moment. I'm going to do it right. And he puts it all together. But one of the things he has to do, obviously, is they need to go check the house in the hill. And then he doesn't return. So they send some other people up there. It goes really badly. Also, the TV is broken, so the TV repairman comes. That also goes really badly.
And that guy, the TV repairman, now he's got some Don Knotts energy, if you want to talk about small-time sheriff.
He does.
People.
What's happening, everybody?
Well, apparently his biggest role was on the Batman TV series from the 60s. He was like random cop in a lot of episodes, so it works out well for
whatever
him in the
you
future,
say, Chief O'Hara.
Yeah, right. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. But it's a so you when they're in the pressure cooker of that house overlooking where they're going to assassinate the president, it gets really interesting. There are, like, you know, Frank Sinatra is going to threaten the kid. He's going to use that as leverage over the mom, and of course the sheriff is there, but the sheriff is sweet on the mom, and, you know, the last thing the sheriff wants to do is risk the safety of the boy, not just because he's an innocent child, but also because it's going to eliminate any possibility of him marrying the mom. And that's how I read it anyway. The guy who's the Secret Service, who is the Secret Service, the dad or the grandpa, right? He's eliminated. Isn't he eliminated quickly, or no? It's the other Secret Service guy that's eliminated.
It's
quickly.
The guy that comes with the sheriff to the house,
right.
Who is actually
right.
a Secret Service
yes.
guy.
Yes, he's gunned down.
Who used to work under Pop.
Under Pop,
AKA
right, the
Peter.
Grandpa. But so you end up with this pressure cooker where there's the grandpa who was in the Secret Service, and the sheriff, and the mom, and the kid, and these three, and then later two hoods who are going to do this job. And they, you know, there's like, they got to go get some medicine because the sheriff gets shot in the arm. And so they got to, like,
Pop has a heart condition.
So they got to get his medicine. And there's like a toy gun, but there's also a real gun. So the kid does a switcheroo where he's got the real gun instead of the toy gun. There's just a lot of cranking up of the tension.
I believe it's Chekhov's toy gun.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
From Chekhov toys.
If a child plays with a toy gun, then later it must be swapped for a real gun and fired.
Come down to Chekhov's toy store. All our toys have meaning.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, that's, for me, I mean, there is a scene where they send one of the hoods down and it you know, to check out what's going on. He's spotted at the phone booth and it leads to a shootout and he kills a guy, but he dies too. And it's, and that, then they know something is going on, but the train is going to be there. But most of the action is this psychological ratcheting up of the tension in the house where they're like, if we, you know, they might kill us when they're done, or they might just leave. But if that happens, the president is dead. So we have to do something, right, to protect the president. Me, the sheriff, you, the former Secret Service agent. We've got to do something. But what are we even empowered to do here? And you're just a TV repair kid. Surely you can't help at all. And the answer is, he clamps like a thing from the mains to the TV to the metal table that they're going to use to snipe the president, which is going to electrocute the sniper. And like, it just, I really liked that heart of this movie, that it is this, it's a bunch of people in an enclosed space bottled up with an enormous amount of tension and a ticking clock. I thought it was really effective.
And everything is important. I mean, we joke about Chekhov's guns, but everything plays a part. This movie isn't long enough to waste any time or to waste any, you know, tangents or anything.
Yeah.
What you see comes into the story every time.
It reminds me of a movie called The Desperate Hours, which stars mm-hmm. Frederick March, who we'll talk about in a little bit. That movie takes forever. And it's Bogart's last movie, and Bogart is the bad guy. And it's a home invasion movie where Frederick March and his family are being held captive. And it just takes forever. And this movie, David's right, it doesn't waste any time. And it's the way it's laid out, too, people move around and there are enough characters that it doesn't really feel claustrophobic. Obviously, you feel the fear that the characters do, but there's enough going on that you're not just, you know, turning away from the screen because it's the same old thing for 20 or 30 minutes.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm realizing my dad probably loves this because he's a train buff and he's an electrical engineer. And this has trains and electricity as a plot point.
It does.
And it really handles does. Both of them very, very realistically.
Yes.
It does.
So this is a movie that I enjoy, but I really hate some of the overriding thematic stuff in ways that make it a thing that I'm like, oh, I'm going to be on a podcast, I'll rewatch it. But I don't go, oh, suddenly I've got to rewatch that one, where the abrasive, browbeating, misogynist sheriff gets exactly what he wanted at the very beginning, which was to browbeat this nice lady into being his girlfriend because everybody needs a gun. And the moral of the movie is, if only they'd given that kid a real gun from the beginning.
Yeah. Good kid with a gun can stop a bad kid with a gun.
Spoiler alert. We watched two movies with very large casts and there are a total of two women in both true. Casts. So.
Yeah.
Shelley, I said it earlier, stop being such a woman.
Yeah.
I know. Put me in my place.
To quote Sheriff Bud, or I forget his name now.
Todd.
Todd.
Sheriff Todd.
Todd. Sheriff Todd Shulman.
With one D.
Todd with one D, damn it.
Yeah, this movie is so economical, he only has one D in his name.
He's too busy catching bad guys.
There is a remake directed by Uwe Boll with
yep.
Ray Liotta. Where the sheriff has two D's.
So extravagant.
Audiences would never believe a man with only one D in his name.
That's right.
And Dominic Purcell plays the Frank Sinatra character, which is trading down.
Yeah. Sinatra having him in this movie, like, he's got the banter. There's a lot of banter. He's like a charismatic villain, which is good. I was thinking, like, this is a good... I was actually reminded a little bit of Die Hard, where it's sort of like, yeah, I kind of like the villain. He's charismatic.
He
talks.
I don't think he's anywhere near as charismatic as Alan Rickman.
No, but Alan Rickman but has a whole skyscraper. This is a very small ranch house. So
and also for a 1950s movie where bad guys were supposed to be like Snidely Whiplash with the mustache, it's a very... he's a very alluring form
he
of evil.
He wears a hat in the house, people.
There's a whole like psychological aspect to like who is this guy and like the fact that he keeps telling different stories about how he got his Silver Star and how he really obviously wants to believe that he's the hero of the story, even though he's the villain. I enjoyed all of that. Also, it leads to one of the great lines of movie history, if you ask me, which is, you're embarrassing me in front of the sheriff. Which,
not in front of the Klingons.
I think that is great. Guess what? The president doesn't die because the first thug gets grabs the sniper rifle, which has been electrified. And... in a kind of delightful scene, because he's being electrocuted, he just keeps shooting the gun and sort of moving around, and so everybody is alerted to the fact that there is a shooter, an active shooter up on the hill. The presidential train just goes right on through, doesn't stop because they know that something bad is going on. That was after they killed the guy they sent down into the street. They did that. Mm-hmm. And then they, in the end, they use the switcheroo kid gun after it is, you know, variously on the floor and being kicked around as they try to fight Frank Sinatra. And in the end, the mom shoots him. And then, of course, our friend the sheriff shoots him the killing blow, and they bond over their shooting another man, and therefore they can be together forever.
Well, in suddenly we're married in some cultures already now because we've killed a man together.
Yep. That sweet date where we both shot a man and saved the president, but you know that wasn't the important
part. And the
part.
Gun that we used is in Timmy's scrapbook.
There's their funny story for the profile on them after they've been married 40 years, and the local paper comes and says, "Hey, how did you two meet?" And they say, "Well, funny story.
Yeah.
One time a guy came to kill the president in our fly spec town, and we shot him together."
Yeah.
And we've been inseparable ever since.
I shot to incapacitate, and then he shot to kill.
Yeah. Aww.
This movie would have only been more romantic had they punched a communist in the face.
I also really enjoy Frank Sinatra at the end after his little buddy gets fried and the train keeps going. And Frank Sinatra realizes he's not going to get paid, and how he just becomes a crying little baby.
Yep.
I think that's great. I think that's a great progression of that character.
He's like, I didn't get to kill the guy. Come on.
But that's part of the moralism of the era. I mean, you have to do that because you've basically made him a charismatic villain and you've shot him at the end, but you have to humiliate him as well, which is what Sterling Hayden has been trying to do for the whole movie. And because Frank Sinatra is the star of the movie, you have to drive the point home in a rather aggressive fashion. Does it bother anybody else that when Paul Frees goes down into town and kills and gets killed, that's not the point, presumably, at which the train path is stopped, or when Frank Sinatra thinks, you know what, maybe they won't have the train behave as it was expected to behave. It doesn't occur to him at that point.
No, that's one of the flaws of the plotting of the movie.
I think they even suggest that as soon as that happens, they decide not to stop the train in town.
Yeah, they retroactively mention that was when the decision was made later in the movie. But I mean, to me, it sells the fact that Sinatra's hood is not thinking everything all the way through and is maybe not the smartest guy.
And maybe wants to kill the president because it'll make him a big man, right? Like, regardless of the contract or something like that. But yeah,
well, remember that moment, he knows a lot about presidential assassination history. He knows about Garfield and McKinley and the attempt on Roosevelt. That's deep cut. But my initial opening line was going to be, I'm really glad we're here to discuss Stephen Sondheim's assassins.
I was just going to say,
he just wanted to be part of assassins.
He saw the off-Broadway production and said, okay, now I know what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Neil Patrick Harris could have played me.
I can't believe no one has brought up Deputy Slim, who, for my money, is one of the greatest actors in this movie, for delivering the line, "Did some galoot discover uranium?" when people are rushing around. And yeah, good read, Slim. Well done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good old Slim.
Slim dies. Well, no, actually, Slim is shot, but Slim will recover. The TV repairman dies.
TV repairman dies, and of course, the guy they send down to to check it out is
R.I.P. Paul Frees.
Yeah.
I also want to point out, I stream the movie on Amazon, and the print of this movie,
IMDb TV.
I don't know through what source it was, but the print of the movie that they streamed digitally, anytime someone smoked, and it was a lot because it's the 1950s, anytime someone lights up a cigarette, they digitally altered the picture so that it was blurred around their mouth in this movie in which six people die.
Wow.
Yeah, I did not see that on Paramount Plus, which is
neither did I.
That's
why you pay for Paramount Plus. Paramount Plus.
Well, and when the movie was colorized by the Hal Roach Studios, what is Frank Sinatra's famous nickname?
Old Blue Eyes.
Yeah, Old Brown Eyes. Really.
Yeah, they colorized
the
his eyes brown.
The chairman of the board of assassins.
Well, that's acting, okay? Acting. He acted brown.
He acted so hard, his eyes changed color.
Don't it make my blue eyes brown?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I think everything kind of runs together, but I want to say that in dialogue right at the end, they mentioned that the TV repairman is like critical, but he's going to be okay.
No, I think we've got it. Slim lives, the Slim, TV
okay.
repairman does.
That's the thing.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Slim, we got guys called Slim. We got guys in the other movie called Jigs. We got all these nicknames. Yeah. I can't
Inch
keep
the
any
kid.
Of these guys straight.
Yeah, it's Judd the TV repairman didn't make it. There's like a really quick, like, no, he didn't make it, but the other guy's going to live.
But what about who?
It also depends on which version of Suddenly you've seen, because it fell out into the public domain, and there are, it's either 75 minutes, 77 minutes, or 82 minutes. So you could have seen,
who knows?
You know, maybe there was a line that saved Judd, and maybe they cut the line.
Well,
the
version on Paramount Plus is titled with an exclamation mark, so that I guess they...
Well, that's what the original, the movie poster was.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
because suddenly
it's like I said, it is taut and very one act play in that house, mm-hmm. and it's short. And I think the Sinatra performance is fun, and so I liked it.
It's no a musical from the 1930s, but it's okay.
Could I just say, because I can't help calling out actors, of course, Paul Frees, who I've mentioned, who is quite the well-known voice actor from Rocky and Bullwinkle to everything you can possibly think of, especially in the 50s and 60s and in the radio era before. But I like James Gleason, who's usually just sort of a galoot guy in earlier movies and a sidekick and not very interesting. And I never really liked him all that much. But as Pop, he's just like a calm present. He's a little bit, oh, back in my day when I was in the Secret Service, but not too much. He doesn't overdo it. And I really like that. And I think, you know, especially when it's contrasted with Sterling Hayden being ridiculous and Nancy Gates being boring. I enjoy James Gleason. I enjoyed Paul Frees as the short tied thug who doesn't make it to the end of the movie, and Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, James Gleason deserves more credit than he gets. He's not flashy. He's one of those that guys that showed up in everything from Night of the Hunter to Arsenic on Old Lace and loads of other stuff.
I forgot he was in Night of the Hunter. Oh my God, you're right.
Yeah, he's one of those comfort food character actors that was in loads of movies that everybody knows for the stars.
My only final thought is, my big complaint with Frank Sinatra as a performer, whether it's on stage or in a movie, is that he never wanted to look uncool or ridiculous. And in this movie, he does look uncool and ridiculous in parts. And I think that's why it's a good performance by him.
All right. Well, let's move on to 7 Days in May, 1964. John Frankenheimer, from a screenplay by Rod Serling, starring Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas. Also, Frederick March is the president of the United States. And Shelley, hey, Ava Gardner's in it. She's the only woman in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Helen Klebe. She's over here going, hi, I've just come into the door to give you a message. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't count.
does not count.
Ava Gardner's performance is also listed more prominently than it is,
it appears,
in my opinion. Yeah. Yes.
But it's such an inspiring role for women, being a kept woman. Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as I said earlier in our conversation, so Burt Lancaster and Ava Gardner go way back to The Killers in 1946, as Edmund O'Brien was also in that movie. So if I want to imagine the history of Burt Lancaster and Ava Gardner, I guess I'll do The Killers rather than this movie.
Sure. Well, this one is taut, though not as taut as the other one, because it's a bit longer.
It's longer. It's two hours long.
And it unravels at the end, I think, a little bit. Mm.
But there's a lot of good stuff in here. So this is also black and white. This is a really kind of a thought experiment. I don't know the background of the book and then Serling's screenplay, but it seems to be very much sort of like, what would it look like if there were an attempt by the military to overthrow the U.S. government? What would it look like, and how would it unravel in a very kind of, in some cases, almost like a serious documentary, like kind of like, let's imagine what all the president's men kind of thing would look like if it was the military trying to
overthrow the government. It was a book that from 1962, which Kennedy, who was president at the time, actually liked and encouraged that movie, the movie to be made, so much so that when they filmed the scene in front of the White House at the beginning where there's protests, he arranged to be in Hyannisport that weekend so that they could film without interference of presidential security and the like. So he really wanted this made. It came out in 64, obviously, after he died, but he
was... In fact, it was delayed. It was going to come out in December of 63, and people didn't want to see that.
No.
This and Dr. Strangelove, both for December 63, and both delayed for obvious reasons. Mm.
Right.
And this is a part of a cycle of political movies. There's The Best Man. I guess you could go back to The Manchurian Candidate. But this 3 or 4 year, Dr. Strangelove, of course, Failsafe, where there's just a bunch of political thrillers. I would argue that this is the one of the ones that sort of takes the premise farthest out just in terms of what's the most terrible thing that could happen? The military decides that it's going to take over the government. It's not a spy movie in the traditional sense. So it's interesting. I hadn't seen it in a really long time. And for some reason, I was thinking more of The Best Man, which is more like a political intrigue drama from the same year.
Yeah.
And I saw this and I was like, oh, so I see.
One of the things that I think is interesting about the way this movie is structured is... It has a few different parts. And the first part, Shelley, when you talk about like taking this to the extreme, what I like about the first part of the movie, and it's a little bit dense, but it really is like the movie is concerned with how would it work? Like, what would it look like? How would you do it if you were a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who was conspiring to overthrow a president who was doing things that you believed? And again, I think that there is to a certain degree sympathy, or at least the villains of the piece are not cartoonish. Well, I mean, they get more cartoonish as it goes, but they are, you're trying to understand why these military men would move against the Constitution. And it's because they believe that the president is going to get everybody in the United States killed by the Russians by signing a non-aggression pact and scrapping all the nuclear weapons.
A disarmament pact. Yeah.
But the flaw in that is that there are all these conspirators led by Burt Lancaster's character, who's this charismatic, dare I say, right-wing patriot, but the other people who are equal to him in rank because he has the support of all the service heads are not pictured at all. So you don't really have this sense of like how he's brought this large group together. And that sort of messes with because, the integrity of the movie.
Because I think the movie is more interested in the first part. So like, I find the first 15 minutes of this kind of, if not impenetrable, very difficult to get around, because it is almost most concerned with the logistics of overthrowing the government, which is like, okay, and it's funny because the last half of this movie is psychological. The last half of this movie is a bunch of people who've sworn allegiance to the Constitution being challenged about their behavior and the delusions they tell themselves and all of that. But the first part of it, there's an awful lot of like, how would you do it? Well, you set up a secret base and there's like a secret code word, and they're and of course it's Kirk Douglas who basically figures out that something very strange is going on and brings it to the attention of the president. But I think it's really interesting that the first part is very nuts and bolts. It's very, I'd say,
procedural.
Yeah, it's procedural. I would say in terms of like a sci-fi, I mean, it's Rod Serling, a speculative fiction work about like, how would it work? Like focused on not as much about the people at that point, but like, how would you do it? And that's the first part of the movie. And then the second part of the movie is much more of like, who are these men and why do they do the things they do?
That's actually more of the middle part of the movie, because the very first part of the movie, we start with silent protests at the White House
that then
become violent, which is super weird. Like nobody is talking and then all of a sudden there's violence. And then you spend some time with the president and his inner circle. And my first note was, oh my God, how many middle-aged men are in this movie? And the answer is all of them.
All of them.
And we spend a lot of time talking about the president needing to get a vacation and who are the people that he trusts, and Edmund O'Brien is sweaty and all this kind of stuff.
He's got high blood pressure.
And you don't know what's going to happen. You sort of, I'm thinking to myself, do I really want to spend time with these characters, especially Edmund O'Brien at that point? And then the plot starts to reveal itself. And so that it takes,
I think,
like,
you are being very disrespectful to Senator Foghorn Leghorn.
I say, I agree with Mr. Phil Michaels.
The one part of the first part, the way it unfolds that works for me, is that by the time we get to the fact that there's a plot on the government, you're sort of connected to these characters and you're like, wait, is this really what's happening? Oh,
yeah.
Why not?
And it's not even just that. It's that you start with that silent protest. You're getting the names of the people and we don't know anything about them yet. And so they both have people protesting them and supporting them. And then you start to meet the president and you're not really all that impressed by him. He's kind of just there, right?
Yeah. I was kind of like those protesters had a point, honestly.
Right.
Yeah. He's
screw
a sickly
this guy.
Old man.
Yeah. What a jerk. I don't like
but
him.
But then you've got Brett Lancaster just Lancastering it up all over the screen.
Well, I'll tell you this, Senator. We're going to, the Soviets know our weaknesses and
you know,
I'm going to bloviate in the most velvety way I can.
And you don't always get actors who can command the screen with their back to the camera. You know, his introduction is completely facing away in close up and it's great. And so, yeah, by the time, you know, I like the impenetrability of the plot at the beginning because you don't really know what's going on. You're just as kind of in the dark as Kirk Douglas. And then the middle part, everything starts to connect. Everything starts to make sense. All of these people go out and piece it together. And then the last third of it turns into a very Rod Serling speaking into a dictaphone when everybody's sitting in chairs. But that sometimes works because the Twilight Zone.
I mean, he writes good speeches. They're speeches, but he writes good speeches.
Shelley mentioned speculative fiction, and that's something that I wanted to circle back on because I saw something shocking and alarming that I gather audiences of the 1960s also found shocking and alarming, and that was a blinking digital clock at the Pentagon.
Oh, yes. It clicked, too.
The sound of it would have been maddening if you were sitting there.
The book and the movie were set in the not-too-distant future.
1970.
Oh, 1970.
What?
1970 or 1975.
The future.
The future,
look at the license
you say.
Plates.
How does this fit into the remit, you say? Here's how. Projection slide screens. when they FaceTime.
Video conferencing,
They kinescope FaceTime later.
I liked all the knobs on the TV, so is that for contrast and brightness?
That's the thing, is you got to have a lot of knobs.
One of the things that cracked me up about those FaceTime conferences is that almost every one of them is actually looks like they could be done. And the one with Burt Lancaster, where it keeps cutting back to him, he's clearly sitting at right angles to the TV phone, and yet when you see him on the other
where's
end of
the camera?
Call, he's
where
looking
is the camera?
Straight at it.
It's just magic.
Is that how center stage works? In
it
the
is.
60s?
That's how it works.
That's why it's so thick, Shelley. It's so thick.
Well, because they want. So one of the challenges is that they want to get you to buy the premise that this is a president you've never heard of, and he's done a thing already when the movie starts that you've never heard of because it hasn't happened, which is complete nuclear disarmament. And so
which you might disagree with.
A speculative premise, right? So you set it in the 20 minutes in the future, right? And it's just far enough in the future that it's that you're off guard and you don't know what the rules on the ground are. And, you know, I like Serling doing this sort of like exploration of like, well, how would they do it? And it's like, there's a secret budget and they set up troops and they're going to take over the TV networks. And he's got a whole plan. I like that part of it. But it is kind of a vehicle for the last third of the movie, which is really like the highfalutin discussions of do you serve the Constitution or not? And Burt Lancaster, who I really enjoy in this, he's a maniac, but I enjoying him in this because I believe that he believes he is the person to save the country.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes.
And that's what drives him. And it leads to those very Serling moments, which is like, who do you serve? Do you follow the Constitution? And it's funny because Burt Lancaster kind of asked Kirk Douglas that question. Kirk Douglas is like, I follow the Constitution. And he says, take a vacation, kid. Get out of here.
We've talked about actors sort of playing against type or playing against the type they were, the public saw them as. Burt Lancaster, of course, famously a liberal person playing a right-wing general. But I would argue that Burt Lancaster's best roles were when he was playing a villain, both this and Sweet Smell of Success. He's really good when he is a character whose moral compass is bent to non-existent.
Well, I like how, again, he's not
a totally evil guy in this, but
no, he's deluded, right? He's deluded, like you would if you were going to overthrow a government. This is the delusion you would have: is you're a general and you're convinced that you're the only one who can save.
There won't be a country in a year and a half,
and you believe that he's competent, right? You believe that not only could he do it, but he's doing it from a position of having planned and executed in an interesting way, and that's much more interesting than like watching Frank Sinatra go crazy at the end of that movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Although, for someone who is supposedly so competent, and his plan really was well thought out, why would he have written all of the plan out in love letters to his kept woman? That never made sense to me.
Oh, I don't think that he wrote out the plan to his
I'm not the so whole either. Plan, no, but, no, but just I, the, his beliefs and what he was going
to
do.
Right, they were very careful not to tell us what was in those letters, which is a thing we can talk about later in terms of how that was used
I
in the plot.
I think it was more going to be, so you think that General Scott is such a great guy. Well, here's his love letters
to his mistress. I didn't read there as being any information about the plot in the letters at all. It's pure character assassination. And that's that moment where the president decides we're not going to ruin this guy. And that's, I thought, a very smart thing in this script is the idea that...
The adherence to bro code?
Well, the idea that it's more damaging to the United States for people to know that this almost happened than, just resign and leave and we're not going to talk about it. I'm not going to bring you up on charges because it would make the Soviets know how weak we are right now. So
separate points, like, because they make the point fairly clearly that they're not going to explain exactly what the plan was for that reason, to preserve the country and to keep... just to keep things under wraps, which is completely separate from he's a bad dude in his love relationships and maybe he said things that would assassinate his character. And I question why it would be off limits unless we're just protecting the Ava Gardner character. That's the only legitimate reason to not release those letters.
I think maybe the fear that he would then, if he was destroyed, he would disclose what he was doing or something like that. And it would. But I agree. It's a little tenuous. It's several leaps you have to take to get there. I think it's interesting too, because that's the great shame of Kirk Douglas, right? Is like, he takes the letters and she blames him and is like, oh, you're working for the general. And he's like, no,
yeah, it might be.
I love that as a little plot point. I think that's great because has spent, and it's clear that he has some feeling for this woman, whatever his mission is. And he feels pretty bad about having to go do it. And then the worst possible thing can happen. Not only has he betrayed her, but he's done so for what she believes is the benefit of this terrible person that she's not in love with anymore.
Yeah. I think Kirk Douglas is being conflicted here is really interesting. He's not the center of the movie, but he's the pivot point. Everything else happens because of him. He does disappear for quite a while in the middle of the movie after it's like, thank you for the information.
Weird.
Now go over there. But there are some good moments. The moment where he is coming into the White House while the general is leaving, which is that moment of like, oh, there it is. Because he's supposed to be also on a 3-day weekend because he supports the Constitution. I think that's all really interesting with that character, that he is put in that situation, but he's not. Yeah, he does disappear. It's a little bit odd,
I guess, although with an ensemble that large, I kind of like it when they don't feel like the star has to be in every scene. And he was the driving force.
Yeah, he kicks it off. And then they put him on the side and it's not. I mean, the other thought. So while I was watching this movie, the other thought I had is, so Aaron Sorkin watched this movie before he did A Few Good Men, right? Like,
Oh, like, several times. Like, yes.
I was like, oh, clearly. I see now. Yeah,
he watched this before writing the West Wing pilot and basically charting out his whole career.
This is probably one of Aaron Sorkin's favorite movies, maybe.
Yeah. I just assume that Josh Lyman is descended from.
Well,
from
yeah, and there's that too, right? There's a Lyman. Yeah. Yeah, it's got to be, right? It's got to be.
I mean, one of the going back to Burt Lancaster for a second, I think one of the things that he was famous for behind the scenes that works so well and why I don't think story-wise we have to see him gathering the conspiracy is that he sells it so well because he appears on screen, as he was known to be on many sets, a massively powerful egotist. Massively narcissistic egotist.
And super charismatic.
Yeah. And he could sell anything to anybody. At least he tells himself that he could.
I mean, that's how he operates in Elmer Gantry too. That's why that
Rainmaker
works.
As well on a much smaller scale, but same thing.
No, he's a great villain in this. And again, I think the fact that he is righteous and believes he's doing the right thing, but is tempered by the fact that, yeah, it's also a giant ego trip for him. But like, yeah, and Burt Lancaster, it is a really good performance. I was riveted every time he was on screen. I think it's really good. It's funny too, because I think I assume the movie wants it to be this way, but like Burt Lancaster is super charismatic and Frederick March,
No.
I think that's his character. I like the performance a lot. I really do.
Oh, it's a great performance,
it's a good
performance. He's not that president that you want to have a beer with.
No,
that's the thing.
What if Adlai Stevenson was elected president?
right. Well, and that's one of the things I love about the movie is that the good person, the person you're supposed to root for, is not the one you really want to go with. Right? He's not the charismatic person.
Right. And
he's
but March,
not a star.
I think March more than a lot. I mean, he had been acting for forever and ever and played leading man roles in the early 30s. He was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in 1931. So March has this long career as a leading man. And then as he goes into his dotage, he does all these super interesting character roles. He did a lot of theater in the 50s. He did Inherit the Wind a couple of years before this. He keeps working for a long time. And I actually find young Frederick March super boring. But old Frederick March, I find incredibly interesting and one of the better actors to age into parts than, because there are a lot of other actors who are like, honey, it's time to hang it up. And he's not one of them.
I completely agree. And he is still, to me, the definitive screen Jekyll and Hyde performance.
Yes.
That was the thing from his earlier filmography that for me, he completely, absolutely owned. And a bunch of his other stuff was, okay, he's playing, the handsome, fresh-faced leading man kind of thing. Good for him, I guess. But he really got to do interesting stuff when he got old and boring, as it were.
You mentioned Inherit the Wind, which was my first introduction to him. And I never liked him in that. I always thought he was really hammy and really didn't do a good job with the William Jennings Bryan character.
I think that's the character. I mean,
yeah, I've seen better.
I think he's better in this.
Kirk Douglas does a better job of that in a version that was done in the 1980s for TV. But I think this is a great performance.
Some of us don't have TVs, Phil.
Well, I'm sorry.
My TV only gets FaceTime with the president.
But I think his performance here and in a bunch of, as you were saying, Shelley, a bunch of his old man roles were really good. And it's caused me to have a rethinking of Frederick March, a March spring, as it were.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, just wait until there are 7 days in May and then you'll be there. No,
Or until they run the Preakness on a Sunday.
Yeah. Well, actually, I love that. Like, talk about defensive fact checking. Is people are like, but the Preakness always happens on a Saturday, and they have a slide on like NBC that says first time on Sunday, and it's like, ha!
And it's on the back of a taxi.
Take
cab.
That, pedants. We know it's usually on
by
a Saturday.
By 1970, the world will have changed. Yeah. It'll be on Sunday.
Apparently, a script doctor came in and just said, And just have a throwaway thing where it's the first ever on a Sunday.
It's fine.
Boom, problem solved.
It's fine. Well, nobody cares.
And see, this is one of those things where, like, Rod Serling famously came up with the ending for Planet of the Apes, and that's the only thing that remains from his original script. But he really, it started here, where originally it was going to be Kirk Douglas staring at that sign, the first Preakness on a Sunday, and he's like, damn it, you did it!
You did it.
Bastards!
Monsters. You blew it all up, you ruined the Triple Crown. So,
yeah.
I have to mention our friend Martin Balsam. Mm-hmm. He's the chief of staff. He's sent to Spain where he
Poor
visits
guy.
With Admiral John
John Houseman.
Admiral John Houseman.
Well, when Admiral John Houseman speaks, people listen.
That's right. True. You know why? That's because he earned it. Yes. Yes. Yes, a very important
you come
here
to
in
my
Gibraltar.
Aircraft character with your brains full of mush.
In your American army. Anyway, he goes
look
there.
Look to your left. Look to your right. One fleet will be disloyal to the president.
Okay, so he goes there. Martin Balsam does, and he gets his confession as being part of the like he declines Houseman's character declined to be part of the plot but knows about the plot and didn't report it, so it's like a very like specific thing they do. But then what happens is Martin Balsam and the entire commercial airplane that he is flying on to Madrid crashes, and he's kept the secret letter in the cigarette box in his pocket. This becomes
Chekhov's cigarette case.
Yes, it becomes a plot point later. My question for all of you is, so did the American military shoot down a commercial airliner, or is this just an incredible coincidence?
I think it was an incredible coincidence.
The idea that they shot him down. Mm.
I do too, although there's no further, the plot thereafter does not give any indication that that's provided Lancaster warning and that he changes anything from it, but I assumed that it was done intentionally.
I assume they had eyes on it and some guy followed along and put a bomb on the plane.
I've never read the book, so I don't know if that is explicit in the book. I would suspect they didn't make that explicit in the movie if it was, because they were very sensitive about such things. Rod Serling wrote a TV film about a bomb on a plane that apparently inspired a couple of incidents, and he famously said, I'm devastated by this. I never want to see that film again. I, you know, just put it away. So they were very sensitive about such things. So, you know,
I think that's why they left it at the plane went down, but the plane went down in Spain where it took off from. And for an American military jet to shoot down a plane over Spanish airspace, even then, that's something that would have been caught.
Even
in
the future of 1970.
In the future of 1970.
I think if you're going to make that a plot thing, then you can do a bit where right after it's reported that the plane crashed, you cut to Burt Lancaster hanging up a phone and going, well, that's that, or right. Or some such thing.
And there's nothing in the story, which leads you to believe, which I actually kind of like the idea that the entire future of democracy in America might pivot on the chance crashing of an airplane, just by chance.
I liked the misdirect aspect where I figured either Martin Balsam or Edmund O'Brien would die, and my money was on Balsam because Edmund O'Brien was too obvious and they captured him and he's just a wreck. And so I sort of liked it as a mixed misdirect, because even though I think I figured it out, I was the minute Edmund O'Brien went to El Paso, I was like, oh, he's toast. He's going to be killed.
Yeah.
And by juxtaposing those two guys being in jeopardy, it increases the paranoia right. that you're, yes. oh, yeah. then obviously yeah. that plane didn't go
I
down.
I say, I'm going to Texas, I say.
You save the one with the cartoon act.
I tell you what, I ain't going to be a target for nobody. I'm going to go incognito.
That's right. They keep bringing me bottles of whiskey, and I tell them I don't want whiskey.
Go infiltrate a secret military base. Haven't gone to seed Senator do it.
The chief of staff, to me, Paul Girard, He sells the fact that what ends up happening is something that was done intentionally to prevent him from going back
right.
was the way that he sells putting the letter into his cigarette case in mm-hmm. that he knows what they are going to do to him. And that is probably the only way that he can salvage the thing that he knows will prevent the insurrection.
And maybe he assumes he's going to be shot. And, you know, how many stories are there of cigarette cases that deflect a bullet?
Yeah, he's just keeping it safe, right? So that if somebody rifle or tries to just beat him up and take the letter,
He is just confident. He is confident that somebody is going to come for him. Right. It's a matter of when and how.
Meanwhile, Senator Clark, Edmund O'Brien, is just driving down a dirt road until helicopters stop him. And then we get the very exciting scene where he talks Colonel Mutt, the friend of Jiggs Casey, friend of Kirk Douglas, to break him out. And they end up doing a very exciting like escape in an all-terrain vehicle after they shoot a guy.
That's a cool ATV.
Yeah.
And then flying commercial back to Dulles.
And then, right. Yes. And then they get to the airport, wait for their flight, and fly back to Dulles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, where Mutt disappears.
Yeah.
Unlike some films that are set at Dulles Airport, it was nice to see the actual Dulles Airport.
It was very new at that time. That was the first thing they ever filmed in it.
Yeah. Very exciting.
State of the art.
And one of my favorite guys is also in the movie, George MacReady.
Oh my God, George MacReady. Yeah. I love him so much.
I finally get to play a good guy because my voice sounds like this, and normally they cast me as Villains Guild.
I mean, he's the most villainous sounding good guy ever in this movie.
Mr. President, we must kill our enemies. No,
I love how he's there for the sole purpose of calling everything into question at first.
Yes.
Like that whole sequence is like, well, Kirk Douglas might be insane. That's right. There's nothing to prove.
You're seeing things where nothing is there. I'm sure everything is fine. Why are you talking like that? This is how I speak.
I get it from my mother.
And I don't remember them saying it in the movie, but I read in the credits, he's supposed to be the Secretary of the Treasury. I guess he's a friend of the president
or
something.
He's a friend of the president, yeah.
I'm just like,
he's,
okay.
He's trusted. He has that scene, Frederick March, where he goes, I want my most trusted men, George MacReady.
Yeah. But he's, he's
hilarious. He talks like this.
He's so sinister and yet is on our side. So I guess he's our guy. He's on our side.
I would like some French toast as long as we're ordering.
I'm glad we've saved the Union.
Was I not supposed to laugh there?
It's so wonderful that nothing terrible happened.
Did I laugh out loud? I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. Oh, damn it.
So in the end, the president does call Burt Lancaster to the White House, and they have that scene where they're giving it back and forth, and he's like, I think you're incompetent and you're going to get us all killed. And he's like, yeah, but I'm the president. And he's like, well, if I could, in a moment of that is like the peak delusion for Burt Lancaster's character. He's like, if I went out there and said that I was the one that everybody should follow tomorrow, everybody would. And he's like, oh, because everybody loves me. And look at your poll numbers. Your poll numbers are down and everybody loves me. And the president is like, yeah, here's how you do that. You run for office in a year and a half. But before that, I'm the president. It doesn't matter what my poll numbers are. I'm the president of the United States and you're not. And they have their little, discussion where it's like, I believe in the Constitution. And it's like, well, I believe in myself, which is just as important.
I really do love that you framed that as the president having a Chevy Chase moment. I'm Chevy Chase and you're not.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, what's more important, the Constitution or me, James Mattoon Scott, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I'm very important. And it is, yeah, I mean, this is speechy. Mentioned it earlier. This is, again, Aaron Sorkin's like, yes, yes, more speeches. Yes, I love it. I love it.
How much more can men speak into their own navels? I'll find a way.
Rod Serling did actually write by dictating into his dictaphone. Yeah. And, every now and then it shows. Now, sometimes the speeches are very good. This is one where they're good.
They're good.
It works. Good.
They're not too long. I mean, there's some pontificating there, but they don't just drone on. Not quite as Sorkin-like as...
One or two of Sorkin's speeches do go on far too long.
Yes.
A little bit. But no, it's... And this is the core of it, right? Which is, it's like you've got to... And how often has this happened in history, right? It is a man who is very confident that he is the one who can save the country and has decided that he's going to go outside of the Constitution to do it. And then the other man, the President of the United States, says, no, we have rules. And it doesn't matter how great you think you are, you need to follow the rules. How fragile our democracy would be if people didn't I can't even go on. Anyway. Yeah.
I love the idea of Aaron Sorkin sitting there, though, and watching this and listening to the speeches and being like, you know, these are really good speeches, but why are they sitting? They're sitting for so long.
Walk and talk, people.
They
walk
would be
and talk.
So much better if they were walking.
Sitting is the new smoking, guys. Yeah. It'll get blurred out eventually.
I did say in that final scene,
but,
though, Lancaster is standing and Frederick March is doing the actor thing. Spencer Tracy famously did this, where you sit.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
the guy
power.
Standing
power move.
Is... The guy standing is doing the power move, but the guy sitting actually has the power mm-hmm. from an acting perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. But I like it. I love that part. I thought it was so tense and it's the, you know, and Lancaster marches out of there like, it doesn't matter that my entire plot has been exposed because I'm going to go through with it and I'm going to give my speech and everybody's with me. And at this point, of course, everything is crumbling behind the scenes to the point where he's in the little studio and he's like, well, no, I want to give my speech. Like, mm-hmm. no,
it's like maybe not.
So reality no. has changed around you and that's not going to happen.
No. So this is where the movie sort of unravels for me, where yeah. we're, because it is basically like someone looked at their watch and
finish
said,
it,
oh,
finish
oh
it,
crap, we got to wrap this up. And so all these people who were really prepared to overthrow the government just sort of go,
I'll resign.
I'll resign. You got me.
You got me.
Yeah.
And, you got me, Columbo.
And
I'm
then
done.
The president saw, well, we certainly can't, you know, punish them at all. And it would basically be the message you're sending is, well, try harder with the Belmont Stakes in a month or two.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
And they name check, I don't know if you caught it, but they name check McCarthy and they also name check this guy, Edwin Walker, who mm-hmm. was a general yep. who was... basically, he resigned because he was a white supremacist and
yep.
he was advocating racism to his troops in on duty. And he resigned, but Eisenhower didn't fire him. Eisenhower's like, oh, dude, mate, we'll just give you a command somewhere else. And then it goes on into the
we'll
Kennedy
just move
administration.
You to another parish.
Yeah.
Right. And yes. and so this the Lancaster character is based partly on Edwin Walker and partly on Curtis LeMay, the Vietnam era general.
Mm. And a little Douglas MacArthur. Through.
Yes.
And a little
Right.
McCarthy.
There's definitely some Douglas MacArthur, which is, I think, the point at which the sort of plot of, well, we could break this guy, but that would break the country, which is why MacArthur, even though he and Truman's battles were famous, Truman sort of fires him, but he never takes the final step of humiliating him because MacArthur, right. like the Lancaster character, has people that love him.
Right.
Right.
When right. you fear someone's base, do you want to stir that hornet's nest? Speaking yeah. of history, there is a tie between this movie and Frank Sinatra, and that is
yes.
In a lie, which is not true, that every time Ben Mankiewicz introduces this movie on TCM, it drives me nuts, where after Kennedy was assassinated, it was spread around that, Frank Sinatra used his influence to make sure that, you know, this movie got pulled, and pushed to the next year. And that never happened. Frank Sinatra never did that. It's interesting that as many interesting things that are very historical that are woven into the movie, that the movie itself generated its own urban legend bits of stuff that is still to this day, over 50, almost 60 years later, still just kind of repeated as fact.
Well, and it's got to be the Sinatra-Frankenheimer connection because of the Manchurian Candidate.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Which he did manage to yeah. to lock right. down for many,
so,
many years.
So it got conflated. And yeah, so we should talk about Ava Gardner as the woman who is in this movie.
I wish she got more of a chance to talk.
Yeah, she and her role is so thankless because she's really just there to be the woman who was the other woman in Burt Lancaster's life so that he can be blackmailed. And then there's a kind of Kirk Douglas connection with her. So she's got her roles are basically as they relate to other to men essentially. And I it's unfortunate. She's an interesting actress. I got as a viewer of late 20th century and early 21st century films, I got a real Liv Tyler vibe from her actually. Is that weird? Is that weird? She kind of reminded
I
me
get it.
I think I have a similar kind of look.
Jason,
kind of
we've all watched Career Opportunities 200 times.
Right? I mean, who hasn't?
It's a very muted performance for her. It's not what I think of when I think of an Ava Gardner character.
The thing about her, she didn't actually make all that many movies. And you think of her having, she had kind of a long career, but she was a long time between movies for a variety of reasons. And like, she made a bunch of movies at MGM, none of which did anything. And then she would get loaned out and she'd make movies that are very evocative, like Night of the Iguana, which is actually, I think, the most interesting performance she ever gives. And so when you see when I see Ava Gardner, even though I know her name, I'm always like, oh, Ava Gardner's in this. Right. And it's not like I can think of 10 or 12 Ava Gardner movies without IMDb here to help me, whereas other actresses of the period. And I think most people, if you ask them about Ava Gardner, would say, oh, yeah, she's one of those golden age Hollywood people. She probably made a whole bunch of movies. Well, she really didn't.
By the way, I completely missed my segue there, which was, speaking of Frank Sinatra, Ava Gardner.
Oh, God.
Well, there's your Sinatra connection.
Sure, yeah, there you go.
They're all connected. It's all because she was married to Frank Sinatra.
She was. And famously, he spent many years being obsessed with her and even more annoying than usual in his attempts either to get her back or to deal with his obsessions.
Well, as a young boy, he probably saw a movie called Suddenly, which teaches bad lessons in that regard.
Bad lessons. So she, you know, again, I find the scene with her where Kirk Douglas goes to get incriminating information about Burt Lancaster. I think it's an interesting scene because it is him, like she and he have some sort of a connection that's been put on hold. And now he's essentially been ordered by the president to romance her so he can steal the incriminating information. And what I like about that scene is that Kirk Douglas seems to me to be very uncomfortable. I get that, like very uncomfortable with what he's doing and guilty about it. And then that moment where she catches him going through the garbage can with the letters in it, like, it's a really great scene. And of course it's doubled by the fact that he's like, no. He's thinking to himself, no, I'm not working for the general, but she thinks he's just there to exonerate the general. And clean up things. And he can't tell her because this is all very secret. He can't tell her. It's a good scene. The unfortunate thing is that Ava Gardner is only in this movie as a plaything, essentially, for various men.
She did very good work with very limited material. And to use a term, I don't know if coined, but at least popularized by Kelly Sue DeConnick, the comics writer, she really was stuck with a sexy lamp part. Most of her role could be completely substituted by a sexy lamp. that moment that you pointed out right there, Jason, is a great moment that entirely serves Kirk Douglas's part and allows him to do good work and do something good.
Yep.
And she is just the sexy lamp that just walked.
I mean,
back
even the way it's shot, he's in the foreground and you see his face and she comes in and catches him and she's there for a few seconds before he realizes that she's caught him.
Yeah.
But that's all she does in that scene. And again, that's not her fault. That's the way the part was written.
She's his backlighting and that's it.
Yes, exactly.
And at the end, you know, there is sort of a grudging tentative, you know, yes, again, take a rain check and put it in a safe place. And yet I can see, you know, 30 years later, how did you meet? Well, the president ordered me to seduce her to get these letters.
But it feels like, I mean, they feel like they need to put that button on at the end, which just a movie trope. It's just not all that relevant or interesting.
I think it would have been much more interesting if he had said, so can I get a rain check? And she just closed the door on
him. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That would have been way more realistic.
And she never knows what his role in this was, perhaps. And he's upset about that, but too bad.
If they would have made the movie maybe 10 years later, that is what would have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very Shaggy 70s kind of ending.
Right. Also, just because this is set in the future, it does not do the Star Trek thing where it tries to do some stuff to say, oh, in the far future of 1970, there will be more women present in things. Like, no.
Ah, yes, bring in dinner in pill form.
It's all middle-aged men, folks. That's just how it is, even in the far-off future of 1970.
No, in the future, women will cook our steaks as we seduce them.
Yes. So
there is a remake of this movie. There are a few more women in it. I don't know what their roles are, but I'm just looking down the list. The Enemy Within from 1994.
The Enemy Within, it's a sort of remake. It's not quite. There's also a Russian remake from 1983. They made it as a 4-hour series, which I have no idea how faithful it is.
I don't think that would be very taut.
No. But apparently at the time when it came out, President Reagan said, oh, things must be changing in Russia if they're doing this kind of movie. I don't know. Who knows?
Did you watch it, Ronnie?
Yeah, probably not. Probably not.
So the very end of this movie is after the president gives his press conference, which is like hilariously, like they come out and he's like, I'll be back in half an hour. And then they go away and then they come back.
That's totally how that works.
And he still has
people
there.
And people are like, we want to see the Preakness.
And yeah, and he's like, the Preakness, but we have the Preakness. We can't know. What are you doing?
It's the first Sunday running.
Oh, no. So all that happens.
What if the horses are religious?
And Burt Lancaster can't, they're not going to put him on TV. And so he gets sent for my driver. Just take me home. And Phil, you know what happens then? The movie says, go home. There's nothing more to see here. The end. And it ends abruptly.
And no one ever attempted a coup against the president ever again.
Ever again.
There is one scene at the end that I really like, though. And it's in the trailer, which is weird. But it's cut down in the trailer. It's the one where Burt Lancaster says, do you know who Judas was?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in the trailer, it cuts immediately to Kirk Douglas going, yeah, it was someone I used to work for who disrespected the stars or whatever his line is. But it's very effective in the movie because he doesn't want to answer.
Right.
And it's like, are you ordering me to answer?
Yeah.
Yes. And that is just a really interesting power dynamic.
Trailer's got to speed stuff up, David. They're trying to sell something. Come on.
Because if they're not going to walk and talk, they got to do that. But I love the power that it gives Douglas's line at the end of it. It's like, that's so much more effective. Mm-hmm. It's really nice.
Yeah. And it is, that's the closure of Kirk Douglas's arc here, right? Which is that he has betrayed his chain of command in order to serve the Constitution. And in that moment, he's challenged directly by his superior officer and gives it to him and says, no, you were the betrayer here and not me. And that's his little moment after he disappeared for a while there because he's got nothing. He's just a colonel. He doesn't have that much to do. Just go see Ava Gardner. Mm-hmm. Come back. It's fine. They don't send him to pick up the senator at Dulles or anything. They could have done that.
He's just a play toy at that point.
I say that was quite a flight from El Paso, I say. Yes, we haven't even mentioned the fact that El Paso is very hot. It's very steamy. He is the sweatiest man ever on film.
Also, there is not that much sand in West Texas. I mean, that's insane. The amount of sand out by when the helicopter comes and lands by its car.
It looked more like, there's sand in the Southwest, but it looked like New Mexico or Arizona.
It didn't look like El Paso at all.
I mean, El Paso is adjacent to the Sonoran Desert, but
New Mexico,
The location of that base to have that kind of topography would have been on the other side of the border.
Correct. Also, I did
whether in Mexico or in New Mexico.
I did love that moment where Burt Lancaster pops in on Kirk Douglas, who's got the giant map projection of Texas and New Mexico, and he's like, "Oh, what are you looking at in El Paso?" And he's like, "Nothing, done, nothing."
There's a really good taco joint I want to try.
Carlsbad Caverns is on this map. Maybe I'm going to tour the national parks.
Yeah.
Usually, I don't get to play with this, and I wanted to know what Big Bend looked like.
I just
want
to go to Juarez for vacation sometime. That's all. That's all.
I was looking at Street View of an X. I just, I wanted to know what was going on.
It does crack me up every time Kirk Douglas goes and tries to do something like that, and the person just walks right in. It's like, oh, you're searching through the garbage. Oh, you're playing with my toy. Yeah. What are you doing?
Kirk
Nothing?
Douglas, not so great at the spy craft.
Kirk Douglas, a good Marine, a bad spy.
And yet they're going to overthrow the U.S. government and somebody leaves a crumpled up note detailing their plans that Kirk Douglas
in the conference room,
just
right
walks in and picks up in front of Burt Lancaster. He picks it up, holds it in his hand for the whole conversation. And at no point is there a moment where he's like, say, that's classified. You should put that in the incinerator. It's like, no, just
burn
to
the
it.
Burn bag. We have burn bags, you know.
I forgot. You've never been in a room with an overconfident white man.
Never.
Every time I look in the mirror, baby.
It's just funny that there's like the one piece of paper that's got all the secret plans on it. It's basically the piece of paper that says secret plans.
And
do
it's super
not
messy.
Give out.
It's like doodles on a, you know, it's like X's and Y's and lines and things. It's.
I also want to point out.
He was just trying to do Wordle.
Two years before this movie came out, there was a movie called Advise and Consent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And in it, Charles Laughton plays a senator from Louisiana.
Oh, yes, he does.
The thickest accent
he
in
plays
humanity.
It so much.
And I was wondering if he was watching this movie and seeing Edmund O'Brien and going, get my lawyer on the phone. There's only one person who could do that southern accent, and that's me.
Oh, lad, he's gone to seed by this point. Man, he's a mess, poor Eddie O'Brien.
Mm-hmm.
I say.
He's still sweating.
Yes.
Yeah. Any final thoughts about 7 Days in May? I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. It's the first part is a little impenetrable, but then there's lots of kind of interesting speeches and some interesting performances. And like, I liked the Rod Serling script. I liked it. I thought it was an interesting kind of thought experiment, kind of like, again, speculative fiction of a sort.
I always like Rod Serling. I mean... Even the lesser Twilight Zones.
Even
I still
Night Gallery?
Just like them.
Hey,
well, the ones that he wrote.
Step off of Night Gallery for a sec.
Yeah.
It was not that bad.
If it's a Jack Laird script, don't watch it. If it's they're tearing down Tim Riley's bar, that stands up with any Twilight Zone.
Okay.
Yeah. Just saying.
What I'll say about this movie as kind of unofficially the second in Frankenheimer's Paranoia trilogy of Manchurian Candidate This in Seconds, as people have classified it at this point, it's a very enjoyable middle chapter in that phase of many directors have been accused or have been studied to have just remade themselves over and over again. And in this case, where Frankenheimer is playing with similar themes in those three movies, this is a very compelling, like if this is the middle chapter, then fine. Good. Manchurian Candidate's the one everybody knows. Seconds is the underappreciated last one. That is excellent. Absolutely excellent. The thing that I think I liked most rewatching it this time was that watching these highly competent people planning an insurrection, I was able to, with the distance of some time from January of 2021, I was able to think about the spoof comedy of the early 1980s starring Val Kilmer that could have been made along a similar plot where, to Jason's point, the secret plans, you know, do not crumple up and hide, are poorly hidden. There are things that, yes, you could shoot holes through a mile wide, but the rest of the movie hangs together so well that you kind of don't care. It's something that, any movie you can poke holes in it, but when it is an enjoyable watch, it is an enjoyable hang. Even if you are stuck with a kind of boring president for the first few minutes, that's just selling what you need to have sold on you for the whole rest of the movie to work. And as long as the rest of the movie works, hey, the movie worked and you had a good 2 hours.
Yeah, I don't think the movie works if you have a charismatic president.
No, it doesn't.
No. I enjoy it. It makes me actually want to see the cycle of political movies of the era. It's been a long time since I've seen Advice and Consent or The Best Man or... Put Dr. Strangelove in there. Very different kind of movie,
yeah,
but of
totally,
a similar
yeah. The
vein.
Candidate. The
Manchurian candidate.
Candidate,
of course.
Dr. Strangelove started out as a straight drama.
The yeah. Manchurian Candidate and also The Candidate.
Oh, you're right. Oh, I haven't seen that. That's been a long time. And as I'll say that I enjoy the older character actors. At this time, mm-hmm. older character actresses were mostly in fright wigs and doing horror movies. Older character actors got to be president, but, you know, such is life in America.
Yeah. In the far future of 1970, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Phil, how'd we do?
We did good. We did good. Yeah. I'm always glad when people like the movies. And in fact, even like some of them more than I did.
Well, how about that?
Yeah.
Strange. Yes, I don't have any ill will toward you for choosing these movies. I enjoyed both of them.
Good. I'll try harder next time. Yes,
I reserve my right to have ill will toward the gentleman from San Francisco.
Yes, next time. Well, let me wrap it up then by thanking my panelists. David J. Lohr, thank you.
Just take me home.
Shelley Brisbane, thank you. And of course, people should listen to your podcast if they want to hear more about old movies.
They should. And if you want to see Edmund O'Brien when he wasn't sweaty, listen to our DOA episode. Can't remember the number, but it's okay. In the catalog. It was delightful.
He's still pretty sweaty in that.
Less sweaty.
I didn't feel like he was. It's funny. He dies at the end of that movie. Spoiler alert. I didn't actually feel like he was going to die in that movie to the extent that I did in this movie. In this movie, I thought he was going to keel over at any moment.
Yeah.
Well, when you call the movie Dead on Arrival, he pretty much tips off what's going to happen.
Yes. And Moises Chuyon, thank you.
Is this EcomCon 1106? I got transferred.
EcomCon.
I was in intro to film language.
And Philip Michaels, of course, thank you for instigating Old Movie Club.
You know, Jason, I always thought you were a great podcast host, even with the rioting and unemployment.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening. Remember, don't advocate for the violent overthrow of the United States government.
That's our job.
Unless you think you'd be better at it, I guess. We'll see you next time.